This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A crisis in the Mediterranean today. A body of water becoming the social drainpipe for a river of lost humanity seeking safety from Syria, Libya, war-torn Nigeria, Kenya, and Eritrea. Migrants looking north for hope, ending up dead by the hundreds and thousands at sea. A ship carrying refugees capsized off the coast of Libya over the weekend.
The Coast Guard are, you know, with the small capacity that they have, are doing whatever they can to rescue lives, going very, very close to Libya if necessary, and you know, working nonstop day and night. But it is clear that they need help.
That's Laurent Joel, regional representative for Southern Europe of the United Nations Refugee Agency, underscoring a tragedy that has resulted in the loss of hundreds of lives just this weekend. 10,000 refugees have landed in Italy over the past week.
I think Mediterranean is a sea and not a cemetery. The problem in this moment is the situation on ground in Libya. If you think about 91% of the people who come from Africa to Italy come from Libya.
That's Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi speaking at a news conference with President Obama last Friday, whose administration has agreed to take a paltry 2,000 of the tens of thousands expected to risk their lives to cross the Mediterranean Sea this year. Traveling to Europe by boat is a big industry for smugglers and relatively cheap for migrants. Prices range from $700 to $7,000, and the conditions aboard the boats are worsening. Last week, Italian authorities charged 15 men with homicide for their role in throwing 12 people overboard on a trip from Libya to Sicily. To take us into this human disaster, Hernan Del Valle joins us. He's an advocacy director for Doctors Without Borders, who is now operating a medical ship bound for the Mediterranean, and Michael McAuliffe, who is chief reporter with the Times of Malta, in the center of all this.
What just happened on Saturday is the biggest tragedy we've seen, but it's not new. The magnitude of it is new. We've been seeing these sort of deaths for the past 10, 12 years since we've had this phenomenon reach the Mediterranean. Mediterranean has been described as a cemetery by the Pope, by various prime ministers, by European leaders. Somehow we don't seem to have a way to manage this problem.
Hernan Del Valle, the pathway to this migration really began with economic migration and economic incentives from the Middle East to Southern Europe. But now it's become really a crumbling of the infrastructure in every way in the Middle East and a desperate means for escape. How does that complicate matters for NGOs like Doctors Without Borders?
We have to remember that it's not just economic factors. We have to remember the situation in Syria, for example, or situations like Eritrea or Somalia. We're talking about people fleeing as well from some of the most violent conflicts that have been raging for years now. So the drivers are very, very powerful for people to flee. In terms of what agencies have been able to do, is Doctors Without Borders has been working in and around Syria, for example, since the beginning of the crisis. And we are currently assisting refugees in Lebanon and in surrounding countries of Libya. But this is a continuation of the issue. Many people, for very logical reasons, choose not to stay in those camps, and they are trying to reach Europe. So turning our backs away from people that are taking very desperate decisions is frankly unacceptable.
Mark McAuliffe, describe what it would take for someone to take this risk, to really put their life in the hands of these smugglers in the kinds of conditions that you've seen or heard about.
Yes, to be honest, I've spoken to many, many migrants over the past 10 years since I've been covering this phenomenon. The reality I find is that the reasons are mixed. So yes, there are people who've described to me really harrowing situations, escaping from personal persecution and real difficult situations. There are others who are looking for a better life. But what's happening, and the dynamic has changed a bit, is that while there was a bigger degree of choice in the past, Someone who would have left from Ghana, for instance, wouldn't have necessarily had his sights on Europe. He or she would have moved into Libya through various stops, through the desert, for instance, and then through a couple of towns before reaching Tripoli. But since the civil war broke out and the security situation deteriorated, many of these people find themselves trapped. So they cannot work in Libya because A, there isn't work anymore. B, they're being, especially sub-Saharan Africans, are being really mistreated, abused. They cannot stay there because it's risky. They cannot go back home. So the only way is out is through smugglers and the sea.
Mark, what would it take for the international community to create an orderly situation for the migration of people from these conflict zones in Libya and Syria and Lebanon and elsewhere? And then, Hernan, I want to get your view as well. Mark?
Look, the reality is whenever we're faced with this sort of tragedy, and as I said before, we've seen this over and over again. The number is different, but we've seen this, and we've had the exact same debate, unfortunately. The unfortunate thing is that whenever there's this debate, we kind of all turn to the politicians to come up with a quick fix solution. And there isn't one. This is a very, very complex problem that we're going to be facing for the next couple of decades, possibly. The first thing we need to be doing is to stop knee-jerk reactions and start understanding that this is a very complex problem that needs multidimensional solutions, managing the integration of these people in our economies and our societies.
Hernan, it sounds as though this is a breakdown of the social order across all of North Africa and the Middle East, and that it's almost impossible for any NGO or a collection of international institutions to deal with. Give us some hope here.
Well, we are aware of the complexity of the issue. No, there is no quick fix solutions, but we're talking about more than a decade of a problem that has been allowed to continue. So I think that there's only hope if what we're calling for is that first and foremost, politicians in Europe need to put the lives of human beings above other considerations at the moment. And there is a moral duty to step up search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. We are aware that that is not a solution per se, but we also are aware that when the Italian Navy did it last year through Mare Nostrum, they were able to reach 150,000 people. We are aware that the organization we are partnering with in launching our own operation now, when they operated the Migrant Offshore Aid Station last year, they rescued 3,000 people. So it is possible to reduce the number of deaths in the Mediterranean today. European governments have the means and the responsibility to do so, and we are calling for them to do so. And of course, when we talk about comprehensive solutions that can address the problems in a holistic manner, we understand that there are a number of factors that play in there. But whatever solutions are tabled have to put the safety, the rights, and the dignity of men, women, and children trying to reach Europe at the forefront. And of course, it's not acceptable while European leaders sit down and disguise pointing at each other that in the backyard we're letting people drown.
Hernan de Valle is advocacy director for Doctors Without Borders, launching a medical ship in the Mediterranean to deal with the people who are lost at sea and dying in the hundreds. And Mark McAuliffe is chief reporter at the Times of Malta. Mark and Hernan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To convey the simple power of life and survival, even when humans are so lost and frail and beaten down, music is something that speaks always to the moment and to the ages. Here a movie theme becomes a classical anthem for the survival of Jews during the Holocaust. Here, composer Oliver Messiaen wrote and performed his quartet for the end of time while in a German prison camp in the 40s. Music to triumph over captivity and death. But here is the actual sound of music singing forth from the depths of a concentration camp 70 years ago. An orchestra of prisoners organized by the SS playing here as free people.
What I saw there myself will always haunt me. Living people too weak to move the dead off them. Living people lying on the dead as pillows. Heaps of raw mangel wurzels among the dead. The only food the prisoners had had for days before our arrival. Human beings had fought each other for half a raw mangel wurzel. There had been cannibalism in the camp. Typhus everywhere.
The music and the voice of that reporter, the BBC's Patrick Gordon Walker, accompanied by the 2nd British Army, he was among the very first to witness an unimaginable scene of human suffering. 35,000 dead, 30,000 living, and the Belsen concentration camp 70 years ago, 5 days after it was liberated.
In these camps, the SS knew what they were doing. Deliberately to treat human beings like animals was part of their attempt to destroy Europe. The world can and must, in a tremendous act of justice, stamp out this horror and punish the guilty. But may I add this? I have seen these things myself, and perhaps because I have, I am convinced that vengeance must not be indiscriminate. There were Germans in these camps. At Belsen, I met German victims, not Jews, but political prisoners. But I do not only mean that. I mean that if we do not discriminate in our vengeance, we shall be doing what the SS would have wanted us to do, namely, as they did, to destroy the respect for human life.
That respect for human life was something Walker discovered couldn't be destroyed. Here he records the first Jewish Sabbath service in Belsen. It was led by the Jewish chaplain of the 2nd British Army.
We are assembled together in this now liberated concentration camp where so many thousands of our brothers and sisters have been incarcerated to hold the first Saturday or Shabbos morning service.
The first month, I hoped there would be a miracle. The second month, we thought, why? All the people before us went to gas. Why we not? It's our fate. You can't change anything on that. So if they had told me I was to get my hair cut, as they did it in many cases, or they would do me something terrible, I would say, yes, just do it and let me live.
About half of the survivors of Belsen were Jews. Gita Cartanegra was 21 and survived not just Belsen, but Auschwitz, too. There were hundreds of orphans here at Belsen as well, perhaps the most tragic sight of all for reporter Walker. He could not capture what he was seeing, so he chose music, singing, to convey this moment. Patrick Gordon Walker led these children who wanted to sing as far away from the corpses as he could, about 50 yards, and there, by the barbed wire fence, their voices called out to a world just beginning to grieve for the horrors of World War II.
Here are a dozen Russian children, from 9 to 14, singing a partisan song that they remembered from before their captivity.
Here, a last rousing song from a group of young Dutch children, honoring their liberators. These recordings are part of a radio archive held by the BBC and WNYC. We are grateful for the work done by Andy Lancet here at WNYC and Henry Sapoznik from the Yiddish Radio Project. The pendulum swings, you might say. In this campaign era, the cost of prisons, the militarization of police, the controversies of aggressive policing and excessive incarceration have all made prison reform a political issue, the way law and order was a generation ago. In fact, undoing the consequences of those once unchallenged campaign issues, like mandatory minimum sentencing, three strikes and you're out, is now on the political agenda of many state and local leaders, who see prisons as symbols of racial inequality, bad social policy, and tense communities. Republican Governor Nathan Deal from Georgia has made wide-ranging prison and criminal justice reform his personal mission. Since his election, he's come to believe that the GOP can be the national leader in law enforcement innovation and the party of shrinking prisons for juveniles and adults.
When I became governor of Georgia in 2011, we had a prison population that had doubled in the previous two decades and was about 56,000 people. We were told that at that point in time we were the 10th largest population state, but we had the fourth highest prison population. So we decided that that was an issue that, from a financial perspective, certainly justified taking a look at, but also from a cost standpoint. Our budget had doubled to over $1 billion a year, and the results were not very good. We were seeing a recidivism rate for adults of about 30%, and even higher at 65% for juveniles that were in our system. So from a financial standpoint, from a safety standpoint, because recidivism obviously indicates that safety concerns are involved, and from an overall standpoint of trying to break the cycle of crime, I thought it was an issue that was worth undertaking.
And would you say that this was a series of mistakes that led to this, that the law and order anti-crime campaigns of the 1970s and 80s really created a mess that you have to untangle now?
Some people might classify that as the problem. I do not say that that is what we were faced with, because I think that was the mentality that prevailed all across our country. It was the notion that if we could just simply lock up people who commit crimes and not pay attention as to why the crimes were committed and why they were in trouble in the first place, then we would all be safer. And it led to things like taking away discretion from judges in imposing sentences. It led to mandatory minimum sentences, which prolonged the time that offenders were incarcerated in our prison system. So I said, let's step back and take a look at it from the outside looking in. And we did that by bringing a task force together and asked them to just take a very hard look at, are there things we should be doing differently? And the result was, over a three-year period, in three separate legislative sessions, we passed with overwhelming majorities, in fact, the first 2 years by unanimous vote in the House and the Senate, these kinds of reforms.
Have you closed specific prisons, and do you have plans to do so?
Well, in the juvenile arena, yes, we have been able to close two of our detention facilities there. We have seen a drop in commitments of felony and short-term program participants in our juvenile system has dropped by about 62% over the first 9 months that our juvenile programs were in place. On the adult side, what we were faced with was being told that I was going to have to add 5,000 new adult prison beds over the 5 years from the time I first took office. This is my fifth year in office. We have not had to build additional prisons. We have reprogrammed some of our prisons to take advantage of increased and enhanced educational opportunities for our inmates, and that is a part of our overall prisoner reentry program.
Would you say this is a race issue in the state of Georgia?
Some people might look at it that way. I don't think that's the case. We did have, as many states have, we had a disproportionately higher number of African Americans who were incarcerated in our prison system. They have had probably the most profound statistical change of any of our population groups.
Well, that is a race issue then.
It relates to the makeup of your population. Now, we still have more African Americans in our prison population than other population groups, but it has leveled that ratio down a little bit to more appropriately reflect the population of our state as a whole.
Do you think the Republican Party can lead on the question of prison reform in the 2016 election?
Well, I would hope it would be an issue that Republicans are paying attention to. First of all, I think you have to convince people that making these reforms does not jeopardize their safety, that in fact it enhances their safety. That's why the third leg of our criminal justice stool, that of reentry of those in our prison system back into our society, is so important. For example, someone who is locked up in a prison for 15 or 20 years, who came in as a dropout of school, had no marketable skills, and after spending whatever time they are required to spend in the prison system, if we send them out, with the same situation of still having no high school diploma, no marketable skills, and a major felony on their record and expect them not to get in trouble again, that is unrealistic. And what we're doing is we are engaging, not only giving them a high school education, we've engaged some of our charter schools who will actually come into the prison system and give them not just a GED, but a true high school diploma. And also engaging on the technical education side, that they can go to an employer once they're released and say, this is evidence of the fact, first of all, that I have been rehabilitated because I have taken it in my own hands with the opportunities that were afforded to me to better myself. And these are the things I can offer to you as an employee if you choose to employ me.
And are employers taking up that argument?
They are. Now, that's something that is a new phenomenon. Normally, it is very, very difficult for someone who's had a major felony on their record to be able to find employment. And that leads to another area we've made reforms in as far as the state is concerned. We have what you term banned the box. That is, when somebody's applying for a job, there are many questions that they have to be asked. One is, have you ever been convicted of a felony? For those who are out of our prison system and who seek employment in the state in terms of state employment, if they have had a felony, they are allowed, even if they have checked that box, they are allowed to have a face-to-face interview with the agency head that they are applying for a job with. We are hopeful that others will follow suit. We've seen some municipalities who've already decided in our state that they will follow that same policy.
Governor Nathan Deal, Republican from Georgia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We have two very different looks this hour at the consequences of law and order policies popular a generation ago that elected candidates and made the careers of many famous politicians. Today, though, prison and criminal justice reform are the watchwords. We'll see how Republicans are leading the way in the state of Georgia later this hour. But at the FBI and the Justice Department, there's been a formal admission that the scale of prosecutions over the past two decades may have resulted in flawed evidence convicting possibly innocent criminals. At issue is the forensic science of using matching hair samples to place a suspect at a crime scene. An ongoing Department of Justice investigation has found 257 cases where FBI agents presented faulty hair evidence that led to a conviction. 32 of those cases carried death sentences. Independently investigating are the Innocence Project and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Chris Fabricant is Director of Strategic Litigation at the Innocence Project and joins me. Welcome to the studios.
Thank you.
So what's the nature of this scandal? Are we talking about bad science, bad practice? What's going on?
Well, this is a particularly virulent strain of the cancer of unvalidated and unreliable forensic evidence being used in criminal trials. And what this audit means is that for the last 40 years, the FBI has been introducing exaggerated and unreliable testimony claiming to be able to associate a particular hair with a particular individual. And there's no database to support the assertions that were being made for over 40 years, and courts has accepted without really questioning. And many, there are at least 74 wrongful convictions that are associated with microscopic hair comparison evidence.
So the FBI has perhaps been more concerned about putting on a good show for the jury and presenting its evidence rather than actually verifying and confirming the veracity of these matching hair fibers.
Right. Well, if you think about hair comparison evidence or really all trace evidence like this, tire treads,
right,
tool marks,
sure,
ballistics, is that there are really two issues. There's one is that the FBI claimed to be able to associate a particular defendant or suspect with a crime scene hair. And number two, and very importantly, they claim the ability to say how rare or how common that association was. And what they had was no data as to how rare or how common it was. Could it be one in five people had left this hair or one in 5 million? or sometimes, often, we would see individualization-type testimony where they claim that the defendant himself, to the exclusion of everybody else on the planet, left the hair at the crime scene. So it's really almost a directive verdict of guilt, and it's all invalid, grossly exaggerated testimony.
So there's never really been a case of figuring out what the statistical likelihood is of any similar-looking or exact-looking hair-to-hair comparison in any crime. The FBI sort of come up with this on their own. And again, I'm not impugning their motives here.
No, I mean, what many analysts did and taught hundreds of state hair comparison experts to do the same was use their own experience to suggest that hair was essentially unique, or that the chances of a coincidental match between a suspect and a random person in the universe was so unlikely as to be meaningless. And they had no data to support that. And so what they used was their own experience and suggested that that was somehow probative. And any first-year statistics student would tell you that that's a scientifically invalid statement.
Now, at the Innocence Project, you're familiar with DNA evidence.
Sure.
Now, in this particular case, DNA evidence does have probative value, and you do have the science backing it, even if there can be cases of wrong DNA evidence, right?
Sure, yes. I mean, wrong DNA evidence is usually a misapplication of the science. Here we have – there is no science to be applied.
And with fingerprints, is that a completely made-up thing, or are there specific statistical profiles that can tell us a fingerprint's likelihood to be exact in a matching case?
Well, people will be shocked to know that the uniqueness of the human fingerprint has never been scientifically established. There are many people – most people believe that they are unique, but – So if you think about, again, going back to the two kind of assumptions of this type of evidence, is that one is that you can make an association between a mark at a crime scene. So if you're talking about a fingerprint, it's a smudge on a wall. And there's evidence, of course, that you can associate somebody with their fingerprints. But the second part, the second assumption, that you could say that this person left this fingerprint to the exclusion of everybody else on the planet, as the science stands right now, we can't say that. Consistent with science. And even more importantly probably is that we don't know how similar two people's fingerprints might be, particularly if it's smudged at a crime scene.
So in many ways, the FBI, in moving from fingerprint evidence to fiber evidence, is basically walking in the steps of history here, not really doing the scientific job of figuring out what the probative value is of any of this evidence.
Right, and that's why the Innocence Project has called upon the White House to advance a strategic research agenda in an effort to validate these claims that are being made in courts today. The National Institute of Science and Technology has a research agenda. They're going to attempt to establish national standards for this type of evidence because currently they don't exist. What somebody is saying in Mississippi will be different than somebody saying in New England, which is different than somebody saying in California. So we at the Innocence Project advocate for upstream remedies to establish national standards through the Organization of Scientific Area Committees and the research that's being done by NIST. Unless and until we do that, the claims that forensic practitioners are making in courts are speculative.
Finally, before we go, with all these crime shows, with all this sort of scientific evidence going on here, juries seem to have aha moments when they think about fingerprints and fiber evidence. Mm-hmm. Are lawyers hip to this? Are defendants able to say, hey, wait a minute?
Well, I mean, the sad history of the use of unvalidated and unreliable forensics in criminal courts suggests that, the scientific illiteracy is a huge problem in criminal justice. So I think that there's a dawning of a realization given the number of wrongful convictions and the 2009 National Academy of Sciences report on the state of forensic sciences, which found really only DNA evidence is a reliable technique.
Chris Fabrikin is Director of Strategic Litigation at the Innocence Project. Thanks so much, Chris.
My pleasure.
Later, we're talking to Sidney Padua, author and illustrator of the new graphic novel, The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage. Charles Babbage is the inventor of the first computing machine. His collaborator was Ada Lovelace, daughter of the poet Lord Byron.
Her mother was very afraid that she'd turn into this crazy poet like her father, so she taught her very strictly in science and math and to think very logically about things. But she still had her father's temperament. She was quite imaginative and a bit wild. So when she met Babbage and he told her about this machine, she completely fell in love with the machine and the idea of it.
Give us a woman from history who you think needs some superhero recognition and why. We'll talk more about Ada Lovelace later on the program. Have your say at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Great graphic novelists create unforgettable superheroes, but graphic artist Sidney Padua used her art to bring alive someone who became an unforgettable hero the moment she learned about her. Mathematician Ada Lovelace, who died in 1852, quite literally imagined the world of software and computer algorithms that govern all our lives today. She was also the daughter of super poet and creator of romantic heroes Lord Byron. What Sidney Padua has done is create a new world for Ada Lovelace and the far better known, because he was a man no doubt, inventor-collaborator Charles Babbage, who is widely credited with inventing the computing machine, a theoretical gadget Lovelace and Babbage dubbed the analytical engine. Novelist Sidney Padua has found quite a pair. The girl with the unstoppable brain, the male inventor, 24 years her senior, part poet, part genius, this Victorian odd couple dedicated to crime foiling and cleverness is easily worthy of Holmes and Watson with a title to match, The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage.
Babbage was kind of the classic inventor. He was the Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge, which was Newton's chair, and it's Stephen Hawking's chair as well. So it's kind of the official genius mathematician position. And in the 1820s and 30s, he was very, very famous as this guy who had invented but not actually built this incredible machine, which was a calculating machine. They called it Babbage's Great Calculator. And it was actually what we would now recognize as a computer. It had programming through punch cards. It had a memory. It had a CPU. It was just completely made out of cogs and powered by a steam engine. This was all plans. It was all on paper. But for him, he was a mathematician. For him, it was a way of doing mathematical tables, which was a big problem at the time, was doing accurate mathematics. He met Ada when she was 18, and she was the daughter of Byron, the great poet, and she had been raised with logic and mathematics. Her mother was very afraid that she'd turn into this crazy poet like her father, so she taught her very strictly in science and math and to think very logically about things. But she still had her father's temperament. She was quite imaginative and a bit wild. So when she met Babbage and he told her about this machine, she completely fell in love with the machine and the idea of it. But for her, it wasn't about arithmetic so much as this way of manipulating information in general. When she wrote her paper about it, she said any subject in the universe that involves the relations between things could in theory be processed by this machine with the right sort of programming.
And that is a leap that is, I mean, Babbage says, okay, we can grind out these calculations for engineering numbers that are needed to build things, which is what he was trying to do with his analytical engine. But suddenly, Lovelace springs almost two centuries beyond that and says, no, this is information science, that essentially all things that can be expressed as relationships to each other are information and would be material that this kind of a machine could manipulate. I mean, that is an insight, I guess, worthy of Byron, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's extraordinary because this was even before Boole. I mean, logic, there was a lot of attempts to turn logic into a mathematical system at the time, but no one had really come close. I mean, logic at the time was still kind of this Aristotle-type prepositions in language. But Lovelace was a student of Augustus de Morgan, who was kind of this early figure in mathematizing logic. So I think for her, she was already understanding that logic was actually a sort of an equation, if you could find the right way to approach it.
Do you think it's too sentimental to suggest that she had this kind of poetic insight about mathematics that directly relates to Byron, or is that too much, making too much of it?
No, not at all. I mean, she herself, there's a letter which apparently she didn't send that she wrote to her mother saying, you will not allow me poetry, but will you allow me poetical science? And she's quite poetical in the way she describes the machine. You know, she goes into these big flights of fancy about, you know, suppose that music, the relationship between sounds could be, she didn't use the word algorithm because I'm not sure if it existed then, but if you could find an algorithm to create music, you could do it on this machine. So she herself definitely saw it as this kind of merging of these worlds of poetry and mathematics.
How did your understanding of the subject of these characters, and of course there are depictions of Babbage and of Ada Lovelace that you could rely on, how did they inspire or in any sense, you know, inform the ways in which you depict them graphically?
Oh, well, I mean, the comic I do is set in a kind of a pocket universe where they actually built the machine, so you can have kind of more fun things happening than you would in the actual 19th century. But for me, the comic was actually just a way for me to express stuff that I just found in my research. When I started the comic was around the same time that Google Books had started their digitization project, so I could just go into Google Books and type Babbage into the search engine, and you'd get this enormous flood of just little snippets of stuff from ephemera, you know, nothing that anyone would have ever thought to look at in an archive. So they really came to life as people because it tended to be private letters or stuff that, you know, anecdotes from people who knew them. So they became incredibly vivid as personalities.
Have you been to San Jose and seen the actual working analytical engine?
No. Not yet. I'm going there on my book tour. I think on the 5th of May, actually, I'm talking at the Computer History Museum, and they're going to do a special crank of the Difference Engine for me, so it's going to be awesome.
It's completely amazing, yes. What do you think Ada would think of this machine to see it actually working?
She'd love it, but I think she'd be disappointed that they haven't actually built the analytical engine. That's the Difference Engine they have. It's just an adding machine. I mean, it's a very beautiful adding machine, but it really is just an adder. It doesn't have the punch cards, so she doesn't get to do her thing on it. But, you know, I mean, Ada got a ton of flack during her own time, and she's still getting flack now, you know. Is she really all that? Did she really understand this stuff? But she didn't care what other people thought at the end of the day. I mean, she just loved this machine and kind of let that passion take her where it did.
Sydney Pato is a graphic artist and animator. The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage is her first graphic novel. It's out tomorrow. Well, here's something for you to take with you today. Have you heard the one about Ole and Lena on YouTube?
This would be a great room to cook lutefisk in.
Oh, yeah, it would. You would love it. Oh, you know.
Fictional characters Ole and Lena may be the butt of Norwegian jokes about the lack of intelligence of certain Northern European immigrants, but hey, the folks in the old country are going digital. The nation of Norway is ditching FM radio altogether by 2017, leading the way in Scandinavia and way ahead of their imaginary expat radio pals in Lake Wobegon or Ole and Lena. Pastor Inkvist is going to have to learn how to podcast his sermons. What do you think about that? Well, that's a good excuse for us to pitch our podcast, which you can subscribe to on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. And to pitch all the ways you can reach us, there's thetakeaway.org. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or just send us a tweet at The Takeaway, and you can ask me anything on Twitter. Every day I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and do my best to get back to personally respond to you, not on radio. You can tweet your questions to me at J. Hockenberry. There will always be radio, but even if there's not, there will always be The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.